Right.
But it's like, a need she sees. Yeah. She like lightly puts her hands on the door. He's got like his shoulder against it. He's like nailing nails as you do.
So there's helping and then there's white person helping.
Hey, applauders. Welcome to Shocked and Applaud. I'm your host, Naomi McQuaid.
I'm Jen McQuaid.
And I'm Lydia Malcolm. You know what movie we're doing because you clicked on the thing.
We're so excited, guys. We had this long debate about what movie to do next. It was tasked to me to pick this episode's movie. And so, originally I picked a movie that we could not do justice to. And so I decided to pick one of my all-time favorites, and it just so happens to be just as problematic as any other movie I could have picked. But in my top three pantheon of favorite movies of all time, we're reviewing Night of the Living Dead.
Dun, dun, dun!
I'm so excited, guys! There's going to be so much squealing. although Ben would say, you heard a girl screaming, you heard a girl screaming! Those ghouls don't make noise! And that's accurate.
Mm-hmm.
For the Romero zombies.
Yeah.
But that's okay. We should probably start where we always start.
Yeah.
What got you to this movie?
Well, I know for myself, it's just kind of been up there as like one of the greats you watch, like Citizen Kane and Night of the Living Dead. And so like I watched this like once a long time ago, not super into zombies, but I did enjoy it. It's not a perfect film by any stretch, but it is still very enjoyable. And like the points that they get, the nails that they hit on the head, they hit it so hard it goes in with one thwack.
Oh yeah, they ka-thunk that right in there.
Oh yeah, that's a better one. Ka-thunk.
Ka-thunk. How about you, Jen? How'd you get here?
I got here because I roped you into seeing 28 Days Later with me in the theaters. And that was sort of our reintroduction to zombies probably together, even though we lived through the 80s.
Yeah, Cillian Murphy took my hand and led me into this love of zombie movies. And it really has gone a little overboard. I might be the resident zombie expert amongst our friend group. I mean, like, I've had to explain to youth kids that I've had in the past just why Jesus isn't a zombie every Easter for the past 10 years. And we can get into that if you'd like to, but my love of zombies is completely unrelated to my love of Jesus. I just thought I'd put that out there. But I watched this movie back when I was a theater kid, and I was like, oh, this is fantastic. And then, because it became public domain, Sean Fact, they changed a title card. And it omitted the copyright, so it became public domain. So they showed it on public access every night. And so, like, if I was bored and just sitting around, I'd flip on public access and just watch it over whatever else I was doing, like, over and over again. And there's no shame in that, because this is a movie that has such rewatchability. I mean, you're going to catch something new every time. And there's going to be a phrase that you're like, oh, I'm going to remember to say that later. You won't, but you'll think you'll say it later. And then, like, it just kind of becomes part. I mean, this movie has become part of me. And I don't think that's overstating it.
No, it's not. It's like one of those moments when you're a kid and you're like, oh, I'm going to gravitate toward this. I'm going to gravitate toward this so hard.
It's true. And for a movie that came out in 1968, it has such a resonance in our culture. And I mean, I don't think George Romero necessarily knew what he had when he like thrust this out into the world, because as an avant-garde type director, you never know. Like you're so intent on creating and seeing what you can do and what limits you can push, that although there had been a number of zombie movies before this, and they're actually not called zombies in this movie, but ghouls, it's obviously a zombie movie. And pulls together so much of what we as a culture think of when you hear the word zombie that, like, there's no extricating it from that whole concept. And so, like, I want to jump in it. I want to live in it. I want to talk about it. I want to share it with people that I know and love. And I also, like, one time, okay, so I think, is this one of the movies I got our pastor to let us watch with the kids?
I think you had an overnighter at our place.
We did Zombieland. a Christian edit of Zombieland, where they left in the word bitch on accident. I was like, oh my God. And none of the kids got into it, right? But then I bought, as a throwaway, I went to the dollar store to buy a whole bunch of candy for that night for a Halloween party, right? Or sorry, a harvest, but whatever. It was a youth event.
Yeah.
It was a safe environment for the kids, and I wanted to bring them all together. I also bought Ernest Saves Halloween, and they did not check into... No, it was Night of the Living Dead. I made them watch Night of the Living Dead. They were not into it at all because it's much more, and I'm sure we'll get into this, but it's much more of a theater type of production. Mm-hmm. It's much more like a stage show as opposed to a produced movie like Ernest Saves Halloween. They freaked out over Ernest Saves Halloween and did not give zero s*** about Night of the Living Dead. And I was like, you guys, this is my favorite movie. You have to love it. I mean, I'm like, okay, we're here to talk about Jesus most of the time, like 99% of the time. But when we do talk about zombies, you have to love Night of the Living Dead. And they did not.
How did you feel about Ernest Saves Halloween at the time?
I remember being grossed out by the movie because I can't do mucus. And mm-hmm. there's a lot of like slimy aloe vera, like yeah. stretchy pulls of grossness that Ernest was always so good at. But I don't remember being freaked out about it in the way that they were with like the babies in the tree and mm-hmm. like the... all the goblin-y looking mothers everywhere in the film. So okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, I give Ernest Saves Halloween a solid, like, it's a 6. And I didn't think that me getting a dollar store Blu-ray was going to be so much of a success, but they really clocked in then. I was a little offended. And I'm not mad about it, but I was like, But it's like if you make a super fancy meal for somebody and the person's like, I'm sorry, I appreciate that you like seared me a steak, but I don't eat blue cheese.
Like, it's like that meme of when you get a fancy toy for a cat, but they prefer the box.
100%. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm glad that you found something you enjoyed in this situation, but that was not my intent at all.
Also, can I just say, I think it's pretty great that your pastor was like, yeah, you can totally watch zombies at this church gathering.
Yeah.
I know plenty of Christians who are like, no, that's dead.
God gave you an imagination for a reason. You know what? If God is this big, fantastic thing, right? Mm-hmm. Omniscient, omnipresent, omnipotent. Like we're supposed to be contemplating the universe.
Right.
He's got to give you space outside your head to do that. And the only way that I could think of the creator doing that is an imagination. And he's probably going to let you have fun with it too, even if you end up in the box instead of enjoying the toy. Okay, so first 5 minutes in and we've talked about God.
And Ernest Saves Halloween.
I'm so sorry, guys, but I'm so excited to talk about this movie.
All right, so is there anything else that we normally talk about? It's been like 3 years since we last talked.
It feels like it's been 3 years. The movie was made, Sean Fact, for $114,000. Mm-hmm. It has grossed worldwide $30 million. So it was 12 domestic, 18 international. It's made its money back. And it's made its money back even though it landed in the public domain,
mm-hmm.
which is like amazing.
Right.
I'm very excited. Good. Okay, I'll stop saying I'm excited, but I'm very, very excited because there's so many fantastic characters and plot twists. And
well, and George Romero is very well known in the horror industry. Like there are tropes or things, I shouldn't actually say tropes. This is like the movie that kind of like defined certain elements, like the going back and kind of jumping ahead here because it's Lydia.
Go for it.
Going into the area that is all closed off and is supposedly safe, and there's a zombie in there. This movie has it, and this is probably the first movie that went mainstream with that.
And good guys turning on good guys, and idiot mm-hmm. sex lamps walking through, and like and like kids being evil. Kids aren't supposed to be evil. Kids being evil.
Evil.
Oh my God! Like fire and mm-hmm. and. It's mm-hmm. I'm so into this.
Right.
This is okay. So previous movies to this, such as like I Eat Your Flesh, or oftentimes they're too much knowledge about zombies because it's a fascinating genre. Mm-hmm. Previous to this, oftentimes because this movie kind of technically is a sci-fi film, which is also a genre that I super enjoy. Plotters, we're recording at my house and there are dogs. So just so you know. If you hear barking, that's just imagine we put it in for effect.
Right. They're zombie ducks.
They're zombie ducks. Which is introduced in Resident Evil. At Dobermans, those were the freakiest creatures in the entire first episode of Resident Evil. You have to admit.
First movie?
No, the first video game.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was video game, then movie.
Right. Sorry.
Oh, no, that's okay. The Dobermans, I was like, oh, this is a great zombie track. Mm-hmm. What do they call it, Jen? Track? Where you're on a track in a game where they move you forward and you're just aiming.
Oh, rails.
It was okay. So it was a rails game. And then like, so you're like stuck in this and they're moving you around. And then I'm like, okay, zombies shooting. But then the Dobermans show up and I'm like, this got real.
Well, Resident Evil wasn't a rails game, but maybe you're thinking of House of the Dead or...
No, I'm thinking of Resident Evil. Maybe it wasn't rails then.
Yeah, you have to press forward and then your character like goes in a specific line. But it's like it's not one way.
Yeah. Maybe it was a cutscene. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember you couldn't look away, and it was very graphic, and it was amazing. But
yeah.
My mom's dogs aren't zombie dogs. They're just loud.
Mm-hmm. Happy dogs.
They're very happy, loud dogs, and they're letting you know that there are things outside. Mm-hmm. There are things outside. These doors aren't secure. There are a million points. You can't even look out these windows, but they aren't secure.
Are you saying that your mom's dogs are Mr. Cooper?
Yes, I am. And tell me I'm wrong.
I won't.
I know dead real from real real.
Oh, Jen, that's perfect. Okay.
Okay.
Where was I?
Opening credit scene.
Hold on a second. I was finishing okay. A point. Now I can't remember what it was.
You were originally talking about how you showed Night of the Living Dead to a bunch of church kids.
They weren't into it.
Right. And then I asked you, tangent about
God's imagination.
Yeah.
The reason we got an imagination.
Right.
The Romero genre. We kind of touched on how there were precedents set in this movie that hadn't...
I was talking about. Okay, so I'm with you now. I'm totally with you. It was previous to this film, most, if not all, of the zombie films were voodoo zombies, which is very loosely grasped on the hoodoo tradition, religion, and about like introducing neurotoxins and like cocaine and to a person to subdue them and then put them through a ritual so that they're under your control. They believe in genuine tradition, they believe they're dead and they're highly suggestible in the movie. They might be dead and under a religious spell of some kind, oftentimes a powder being blown on your face. Like it's a magical, spiritual thing, right? Mm-hmm. This, again, technically sci-fi because of the origins of these zombies, which we'll get into in part two, mm-hmm. probably if not three of this episode.
Right.
But it's just such good storytelling, and some of it could be done a little less brittishly, but
like it's
brittle in the way that it's delivered. It's very
static, very.
Yeah, I guess static is a good way to say it because it's very like, oh, you're getting this chunk here, and it's just the exposition style that mm-hmm. Romero chose, and it works pretty good.
To be fair, there's a lot of like movies around the 50s and 60s and like even some of the earlier parts of movie history that kind of do it that way because movies in that time were still in their infancy. Mm. Like the way that we do movies now is very cinematic. I mean, you see it not just in the movies, but you see that in TV. And so what we see right now is like there's more this gravitation towards natural dialogue.
And you're showing me and not telling me. And
right.
The telling me is what I'm complaining about, I guess, a little bit.
Right. Because it's just like, you know, oh, this is us and this is the situation that we're in. And this is what we have to do in order to get out of the situation. Mm-hmm. So it's very tell, not show. But mm-hmm. we're kind of gearing more towards show, not tell because it is a visual medium.
And to be fair, this is a one room type of a, I mean, the majority of the story takes place in one location. And so to get information from the outside, they have to deliver it to you through the radio or the TV. But we'll get there. So, we should title card. Should
right.
we title card?
Opening credits screen. Opening credits scene. Sorry.
Yeah. Long drive into the cemetery.
Ominous music.
Here we are, Johnny and Barbara.
Yeah, they're going to a cemetery.
Brother and sister out for a lovely Sunday drive.
What are we doing here, Johnny? Why, Barbara, we're going to go ahead and put some wreath on Father's grave because Mom doesn't want to do it herself. Well, maybe we should go ahead and try and resolve that. Nope. Sorry.
They have this weird back and forth where they start explaining what they're doing.
Yeah.
Except it starts with Barbara being like, They should make daylight savings time the first day of summer so that two happy things happen on the same day. And he's like mad because he's like, you say that, but it's 8 o'clock. And I mean, we got another 3 hours to drive home. We're not getting home before midnight.
Mm-hmm.
This is miserable. And like, it's just the bickering feels weird because I don't have a normal relationship with my siblings. I don't know anybody who does have a normal relationship with their siblings.
It's not natural dialogue that you would have with a sibling. It's kind of like where you know, when people are trying to, this is a thing in like plays and movies and television, you have to ask yourself, how am I going to let the audience know that this person's name is Johnny? Outside of just having...
She says it 80 times.
Yeah, but it's still like, it's one of those things where...
She goes back and forth. She calls him John and Johnny. It's mm-hmm. very gross.
Yeah, but it's still like, is that something that you're going to say? Like, I mean, how do you address your brother?
I call him brother. I'll say Abe, but we got all old school biblical names, right? So we all have three syllables or more.
Right.
So like, you're going to go nickname or shortened version.
I have heard you call him Broheim at times.
And Broheim. I call him Broheim.
Broheim. Yeah, that's great. See, for myself, like for my sisters, unless I'm, because I got like three older sisters, but very rarely are all four of us in the same room because we're adults who have our own lives.
Mm-hmm.
So generally, if it's just like me and one of them, Elena, you know, we're just kind of in the room together and we're talking to each other. And if you're in a conversation with like with two other people, you generally are going to make eye contact with a person that you want to talk to. And if they're not making eye contact, you're going to be like, hey, Elena, can I ask you something?
Okay.
I mean, that seems natural to me.
You don't throw a pronoun out like just casually. Like you either specifically getting their attention.
I'm in this two-person conversation. I'm going to say your name a lot, Naomi. It just doesn't sound natural.
I do that with older people if I want them to like me.
Oh, okay.
I had a friend whose name, she had dementia, and I would just say her name a lot. And she was like, oh, that Naomi. And I'm like, I know, it's only because I say your name a whole lot that you like me, and that's fine. I wanted you to like me. That's why I was saying your name.
Good.
Feel free to use that life hack. Be like, oh, pick a random name.
Barbara.
Barbara. Oh, Barbara, it's so good to meet you. Have you met my friend Barbara? Here's Barbara. But this is contrast to exactly what I'm just saying. It doesn't make me like them more in the film because it's not my name. And it feels like they're saying it too much.
Yeah.
But okay, wait. Okay, no. Her saying Johnny irritates me. Him saying Barbara does not irritate me at all.
Yeah.
I like it because we're about to quote it a whole bunch.
Yeah. So they go and they put the wreath on the grave.
He's complaining that she's like, it only takes you 5 minutes. Yeah. 5 minutes with 6 hours drive there and back. And she's like, my first favorite line of the movie is, sometimes I think you complain just to hear yourself talk.
Yeah. And so they go and they place the wreath on the grave. And Johnny talks about this time when they were out there and, you know, he would hide behind a tree and he'd come and jump out to scare Barbara, and their grandfather would scold him for it.
You'll be damned to hell.
Yeah.
Except he sounds all Jewish and they're in a, like, they're
you'll
laying.
You'll be damned to hell.
Yeah. Like, they're laying a cross on a grave and have talked about going to church already.
Several times.
So, like, the fact that he sounds like a Jewish stereotype is, like, a whole thing.
Yeah.
But now we get to the first, I think, mainstream quotable line of the entire film when he's like, oh, you were scared back then. You're still scared, aren't you? And she's like, stop it. You're being ignorant, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes, they're coming to get you, Barbara. They're coming for you. Look, here comes one of them now, which was my text tone. For more than a year. It would still be my text tone if I hadn't switched phones and if I was more of a millennial and actually downloaded all of my content, which I did not. Okay. So for personal reasons, my phone was shut off for a period of time and I was not receiving texts or calls. This is more than a year ago. What was the name of the Awkwafina film where her grandma was dying, but they didn't want to tell her? It was a whole thing. It was like The Goodbye or something. Like, she goes back to her family's home country and, like, You don't know. Okay, well, it's an Awkwafina film. But it deals with death. They're not telling grandma she has cancer in this grand, like, Chinese tradition or this Asian culture tradition. And so, like, it's heavy in death themes. And again, my phone had been shut off. I merely had it on my person so that I could like hook into Wi-Fi or I could like update my calendar or something. Like it was just it was like a calculator in my pocket. Like it didn't do anything except for like take pictures or whatever. So imagine my horror when I'm sitting in this film about death and I receive a phone call, even though my phone was shut off. And the theme was not that they're coming to get you, Barbara, text theme song. It was the thematic music where it's just like, dun, dun, dun. It was the theme song to this movie. And it started playing loud in the middle of a theater. And I was like, oh, God. And like, it's in my deep in my pocket because I haven't been able to use it. So like, I have to fumble and... I really hope no one knew that it was the Night of the Living Dead theme, because that would have been like poor taste. I mean, my life is poor taste, but that would have been like super bad.
Was it an actual phone call or an actual text?
It was like a collector. I don't know how. They must have collect called me or like paid for the fee or whatever, because it was like nobody I knew. It was like so weird because I hadn't received calls for weeks because I was trying to get my whole phone situation settled. It was also funny when it would go off in like a break room and I'd be sitting there alone and all of a sudden be like, they're coming to get you, Barbara. But you could buy them on iTunes.
You could probably just like screen cap just that like little clip and probably convert it into an MP3 file.
Probably. Okay, so the reason Johnny is saying this is because there was a guy walking off in the distance. He looks pretty freaking normal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, he runs away from the man, like play style. He's like, oh, I'm running away from this scary guy. And she's like, she's all squinched up and she's like crossing her arms over herself and she's trying to make room around the guy. And she doesn't say anything.
She's specifically not making eye contact with him like she's about to. She looks like she's just going to walk past him.
And that's when he grabs her. Mm-hmm. And Johnny turns around and he's like, oh, no, not my sister, not today.
Mm-hmm.
And then he attacks the man in what I call a white boy grapple. Because it is not boxing. It is not any kind of skilled fight. It is too... middle-aged white guys throwing each other around a bit, and it looks awkward as heck. It is not Romero must have been like, okay, now go at each other. They're like, how do we do that? And they're like, I don't know. And then they just kind of like grapple.
Have you ever seen Bridget Jones's Diary?
I cannot say that I have.
Okay, because there is the two romantic male leads in that are Colin Firth and Hugh Grant.
Okay.
And at one point they fight over Bridget Jones, played by Renee Zellweger, who is very much American. I just want you to imagine these two very pompous British men, or these two men who generally play like kind of like uppity British men.
Yeah.
And they're just like fighting. And so there's like a lot of grappling and then kicking with the feet.
Like the physical equivalent of, yeah.
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 Yeah. That's a great verbalization for a podcast, by the way.
Yeah. Okay, so the two go down. Johnny's head hits a tombstone. He's down for the count.
Mm-hmm.
She gets a clue, runs away to the car. Notice, she doesn't have the keys. She can only put the car. He, like, starts pounding on the window. He grabs a rock. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the ghoul.
She's pretty resourceful. She makes sure that she gets into the car and locks the doors and rolls up the windows and everything.
He grabs a rock, breaks the window. She freaks out. Naturally.
Mm-hmm.
She puts the car into neutral. It's the only option. And thank God she's at the top of a hill, because what good is it going to do you anyway?
Mm-hmm.
She throws it into neutral. It starts coasting down the hill. She cannot, unfortunately, steer the thing and goes into a tree.
Yeah.
And so, like, then he catches, the ghoul catches up with her. It's this guy in a suit with, like, a shock of hair. He's got this fantastic face that's very lined and pale, but not, like, overly so. Like, you don't know what is his deal.
Right, but his face is very distinct, so when it shows up again throughout the movie, you're like, oh, yeah, that was the first guy.
Yeah. And you never forget your first ghoul. Well, she jumps out of the car, and you noticed a specific detail that I thought was interesting, because I thought she just lost her shoes.
But she, like, when she's running, she, like, trips and falls, and one of her shoes comes off. She's wearing high heels, because it's a solemn event, and they were just at church.
This was before losing your shoes was, like, a whole thing.
Yeah. And so she takes off the second shoe, so that way she's not hobbling. She's just running barefoot.
She's running in the, like, most awkward way. Her hands are up. So she her top frame sort of forms a W, right? And she's just kind of like, wah, wah, wah. She's running down the street sobbing and looking behind her.
She got a very distinct T-Rex shape going on.
I was thinking of Phantom of the Paradise, how Phoenix was like, would dance off stage with her arm jerk.
The herky jerk.
Yeah.
The trying to get the shawl off your shoulder dance.
Yeah. But
she's an emblem, right? So like she is the egg before the chicken.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I don't want to fault her for it because, like, she's panicking, right? And she's freaking out and everything's almost begun to settle in.
Mm-hmm.
She has no idea what's going on. And she's running out into the wilderness, obviously 3 hours from wherever it is in Pittsburgh that she lives. And then she, like, makes it to the edge of a farmhouse and peeks around the corner. And then she like, finds her way into the actual farmhouse.
Right, there's just an open door.
Yes, and she has like, she's got her stocking feet and she's in her trench coat and she's like
So did that farm remind you of anything? Because the first thing that I thought of I saw that farm was, oh, is that Walking Dead season 2 Herschel's farm?
Oh, because just now when you were like, does it remind you of anything? My brain totally went to, because the movie, and we mm-hmm. haven't mentioned this
right.
is a black and white film.
Oh yeah.
Don't watch it in color. Watch it in black and white.
Right.
It's much more dramatic that way. I just now I thought of the house from Pet Sematary.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, not interior wise, exterior wise.
Yeah. Like a farm, like house on a wide open field.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There are some trees close by. It's, you know, the kind of normal slat you'd think of for an old farmhouse. Inside, it's very bare.
Mm-hmm.
During production, they didn't have like a lot of. Like, I mean, it was bare bones. There's no water or anything. So they're like living out of like trailers and buckets and shit outside. And it was like, I think over the course of filming, it was like sweltering and then freezing and never anything but those two mm-hmm. things. So they're way more miserable during the production of this than they ever allude to in the film. You never see it on their faces. It's amazing.
Channel it into your acting.
They do.
Yeah.
They act the crap out of this film. Even the parts where I'm like, ugh. I'm like, okay, it's but you're acting the shit out of it right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so she makes her way inside. She starts to explore.
Yeah. Grabs a knife.
She holds it to herself in a way that is ineffective.
Yeah. Like she's going to get cut.
Yeah. She could easily slice herself at any given point. She wanders around. Doesn't she find a dead body?
Yeah. She wanders around. She like turns on a light and there's like this jump scare that doesn't really scare her, but it's like meant to scare the audience, I think.
Like the deer head or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, well, here's the thing. I like Army of Darkness, Evil Dead stuff. So mm-hmm. like the whole deer head on the wall thing I've seen done better, scarier
yeah.
mm-hmm. other times.
Right.
So.
And then she makes her way upstairs. At no point is she asking if anybody's home, which maybe makes sense because there are people who are out attacking her.
Well, and she's officially coming down from the flight mm-hmm. response to the shocked response.
Right.
And she makes her way to the front door again, opens it up, and then who should be standing there?
Right.
It's Ben.
This is our main character.
Oh, Ben.
Played by Dwayne Jones.
Dwayne Jones. Oh, I need, oh.
And, like, he's so much more equipped to handle the situation.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, Barbara just, like, she seems like the kind of person who, throughout the whole movie, kind of just shuts down if someone else is there to take care of it.
I have 3 sections of my notes labeled the stages of Barbara. And when we get to the first decent chunk of them, I will tell them to you. But right. But we've gone through at least 2 of them already.
Mm-hmm.
But then Ben shows up.
Right.
And this is where I wrote, cue, mute, useless Barbara.
Mm-hmm. Because she doesn't do anything.
He's like, he's got an agenda. He's like, you know, I came here for a specific purpose. Even if I can't fulfill that, I can adapt, adapt, adapt. And that's what he does now through the end of the film.
Mm-hmm.
He's just going with it, going for it, trying to make the best decision he can. She becomes inactive in a number of ways, ineffectual in like so many ways. And the feminist in me is like super pissed about that.
Yeah.
But like the person of color advocate that I aspire to be is just like, I don't want it to be about her. Mm-hmm. I want it to be about Ben.
Right. I mean, she's kind of like, she's the worm on the hook. Ben is the hook. How I would say
okay.
it.
Okay.
And okay, so this was a fact, and I didn't see it anywhere in Sean's notes, but this was something that I gleaned after watching it. There was a moment where George A. Romero and I think someone else who was working on it.
Russo?
Yeah.
John
Russo? I think they were going on their way to an indie theater to see if they could get this show there. And they heard on the radio that Martin Luther King Jr. had died.
Like they were releasing the film and they heard that?
No, they were on their way to negotiate a theater.
To pitch it or whatever?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's when they heard about the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. So this came out, like, what was it, October 21st?
October 1st, 1968.
Right. So this was probably...
Sean fact.
April, May, June, July, August, September, October. So that was 7 months, just shy, or 7 months after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. So the fact that this has a lot of, like, you have a main character who is a black man, who is, like, kind of treated as being a little bit, like, all of the white people around him are very nervous. But he is the most effective. He is the most equipped.
Yeah.
It's very easy that people would find racial coding in this, though I didn't see any indication that that was intentionally in there.
Well, and that's okay. So I have a book with the script in it, the original script. And I think that Dwayne Jones made the artistic decisions that led his character to be someone that I have genuine and longstanding affection for. Mm-hmm. In the script, he's referred to as truck driver, and he has this very, okay, I don't think George was trying to be racist, but what did you say about it's implicit or it's
inferred?
Well,
or implied?
It's the Karen Becky thing. There are people who are intentionally racist.
And then there are people who don't realize that their own privilege actually has racial meaning behind it.
Right. So George Romero tried to write a black man and it just comes out bad.
And Dwayne Jones is like, yeah, we're not going to do it that way.
He's like, I'm about to be a professor and never be in a movie again. In fact, I kind of hate this. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play him smart,
mm-hmm.
kind, empathetic, but genuine, passionate, and just all around amazing.
The way that Dwayne Jones portrays Ben is he recognizes that he's frustrated in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
There is nobody around who's really going to be able to help him the way that he is.
Yeah.
And he kind of is like, he's at one point in the movie, jumping ahead, he says, you can be the boss of the cellar. I'm going to be the boss of the of the house.
You go be the boss downstairs. I'm the boss upstairs.
Thank you.
This is the thing. You see him implore people for help,
mm-hmm.
and they fail over and over and over again. We're going to rant about it, I'm sure. But the fact that he's forward thinking and that he's pressing on and he's like, we're going to get through this. We're going to get through this. We need to work together.
Mm-hmm.
And then a person stalemates him and he like redirects. He's like, okay, either you go fuck off mm-hmm. or you help me right now.
Right.
And he says it in a way that is like, I mean, like if I was there, I'd be like,
that sounds reasonable.
You know, I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
I want to do that. I don't want to not do that. I want to do that right now.
Mm-hmm.
He gives very clear instructions at the level he thinks that they're functioning at.
Mm-hmm.
And when that doesn't work, he changes tacks. And you see that. And I hope we point that out a bunch of times because it's indicative of good leadership.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that nobody there recognizes that he's an amazing leader.
Right.
That he's the best qualified by his sheer presence and the way he's interacting with people. Like, Dwayne.
So let's actually get into some of these points.
Yes,
like the first thing that he does is he comes up in a vehicle with its lights on. And the first time you see him in the frame, it's just he's very dominant in the frame. And
he's silent and he's staring at her mm-hmm. and she's staring at him. And it's like, oh, no.
Yeah. And then you're like, now we got another layer of tension that we got to deal with. But there are zombies who are coming towards him. And he he grabs Barbara and moves her back inside, maybe a little bit more aggressive. But they're f-ing zombies, okay?
Yeah, you got to move, lady.
Yeah,
you gotta
come on.
Move. And then he pulls out. Okay, now in Max Brooks' book, mm-hmm. The Zombie Survival Guide, which I've read like 4 or 5 times. And it was also my bathroom book for a long, long time. And I've thought about this for a number of years. I've been asked hundreds of times, what is my number one favorite zombie killing implement? What's your weapon of choice? You guys want to go first? You already know. You've been married to me forever. What's your zombie weapon of choice?
I would think, are we talking about just any kind of weapon?
You can have any weapon you want. What you get?
Oh, I don't think I've ever thought about that.
Pluck it. You got one, Jen? If you got it right on the top, go for it.
Machete.
Okay. I've only got two of those in real life.
I suppose it would be too much to ask for a sword-wielding bear on a bicycle.
I'm going to give it to you. But mine is better. My weapon of choice is a tire iron or a crowbar.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's light enough to carry anywhere you go. You don't have to reload it. It doesn't, you can cause brain damage super quick. It is the perfect weapon. And I feel like Max Brooks would agree with me in terms of hand-to-hand combat, because overall, it's avoidance that's going to let you survive. Wow, guys, zombie apocalypse. It's avoidance that's going to allow you to survive a zombie apocalypse. So, because it's all about numbers. We're going to talk about that later. But that's what he pulls out. Mm-hmm. I was staring at the film yesterday, and I was like, oh, my God. My God, my God. Mm-hmm. He's got a tire iron. His first weapon in the whole movie is a tire iron.
So he moves Barbara into the house. He shuts the door and locks it.
Zombies are smashing his car with rocks.
They're specifically smashing the lights
because they're too bright. They don't like light.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because zombies using tools is kind of a signal of sentience. So we don't know, like you think of a zombie, if it's only drive is to consume, if it's a carnal thing, right, then them using a tool is a step away from that. It lends itself to future zombie movies and it opens really a window, mm-hmm. I think, but they don't really address it,
right,
except for that they do it.
Mm-hmm. And Ben goes ahead, and after they get in and they're kind of blocked off, he starts asking her a bunch of questions.
Well, he drags the guy out of the room. He's like, don't look at it.
No. This is after the guy actually made his way back into the house.
Oh.
This is a ways after it. So like they're doing stuff. Like at one point, Ben's grabbing food from the refrigerator, and Barbara's being all like wafy, like I can't comprehend things that are going on.
She's officially dissociated.
Yeah.
She is very vacant.
Ben is like asking questions, trying to get her to, kind of get her mind on the, we got to survive. We can't just we can't just stop. We have to actually move through this, because if we don't, we're going to be in big trouble. And that's where Ben's mind is at. While Barbara is just sort of like, I just saw my brother die and there's like these things attacking me.
Yeah, she's a deer in the headlights this whole time.
Yeah. So I think at one point he asks her to go and get some wood.
Yes. Okay, so he does say, okay, this is the first time Ben sets something on fire. He drags a guy outside, pours lighter fluid on him.
So yeah, this is the time where
he doesn't drag him all the way off the deck. Do you notice? It's a wooden deck. He douses it in like whatever kind of lighter fluid. It's a small bottle, so
yeah,
maybe kerosene, but it's whatever flammable liquid. And then he like lights him on fire, which they're like, oh, fire bad. But then it's on the deck, and like the firefighter daughter that I am, I'm like, no, you should move it at least 3 to 6 feet away from the house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's before he gets that guy, Barbara's just sort of like, cowering on a couch. She doesn't see the guy showing up, and then Ben has to come in and take care of him.
Yeah, that happens a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
And so then he's like, I need your help. And like my notes now go, Barbara. That's our air quotes noise.
Yeah.
Isn't that our air quotes noise? Helping. This is Barbara helping.
Like, Ben's asking her to go and get some wood, and he's like pulling like boards off of cabinets.
He's finding nails. He's going through boxes. She walks into the living room and plays with a f-ing music box.
Yeah. And he like goes after a door at one point, and he like is bringing in the door as she's like bringing in. What did she bring in?
She brings in, okay, she's got 4 pieces of wood. 3 of them are the length of her forearm. No longer, and they're like one by one by ones, and one stake, like one, and they were all pieces of firewood next to the fireplace, and she puts them all helpfully on the fridge.
Yeah.
And then I will say she does go over to help him hold the door up, but she doesn't do it well.
Right.
But it's like, a need she sees. Yeah. She like lightly puts her hands on the door. He's got like his shoulder against it. He's like nailing nails as you do.
So there's helping, and then there's white person helping.
there's been like, you know what? We could use this ironing board to shut up this window. And she's like, I think I'll hold this one side loosely with my fragile little hands and then be like, the noise of the hammering's too loud. And then wander to the other side of the door and like lightly push her hands against it and be like, oh, the hammering's too loud. Lady, you about to get eaten. Maybe you put up with some noise. I know I get sensory overstimulation. I feel you about it. But honey, honey.
Yeah, you got to push through that or it's not going to get done.
This is what Jen calls the inception of our Ben Barbara relationship. But I reject that canon and substitute my own. They're both wearing like wedding rings. Mm-hmm. So I'm really glad they're not together. I'm glad that there's very little romance to this film at all, because I think that would distract from what is a fairly compelling story with a decent but not overwhelming story arc.
Right. Like when you're doing action, sometimes romance is put in as a subplot to kind of build up a little bit more tension. But we've done it so much in our lifetime that in 2020, it's just kind of overplayed. And having something like I can see why they would have done it, like would have had them be platonic, because he's a black man and she's a white woman. And that would have probably caused moral outrage.
I suppose so at the time. But like, well, here's the thing. Sidney Poitier had been in films previous to this, mm-hmm. where he'd had a romantic lead with I'm thinking specifically of the film Patches of Blue, mm-hmm. which, to be fair, is on my very limited repertoire of older films with persons of color that I've seen. But it only really worked because the whole premise of the film is that he falls in love with a blind girl and then they don't end up together.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, and wasn't he in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, the original one?
Yeah, but I've never seen that. I've seen enough renditions of it that I'm just like, I mm-hmm. have social anxiety and that kind of business makes me really uncomfortable. And I don't mm-hmm. want to not, I want to be aware of it, but I don't think I necessarily have to consume it. That being said, I've seen much less mainstream things like Patches of Blue mm-hmm. that deal with similar issues.
Okay,
but do you want to hear, we have come across my first completed list of stages of Barbara.
Yes.
Stages of Barbara. Stage one, annoying sister. Stage two, floppy runner and car crasher.
Right.
Stage three, mute shock asshole. Number four, rage screamer. I don't know what's going on. She said that. That's what made me say that. Oh, chair weeper.
Oh, yeah. She just weeps in that chair when that third zombie comes in.
Yeah. And then stunted helper. That's where we're at. We're at stunted helper.
Yeah.
And now we're pulling into what I have dubbed exposition station. Woo, woo. You can do it with me. Exposition station, guys. Woo, woo. Ben starts taking apart a table, which makes perfect sense because it's a large piece of wood and it could cover a large unprotected area. Mm-hmm. But he starts talking about Beekman's diner. He starts talking about how he pulls into Beekman's diner and there's like, he sees a truck being chased by a whole bunch of these things, like 10 to 20 of these things. And he delivers a really, it's barely compelling. Mm-hmm. Like he's doing this work. He stops and pauses. It's really Dwayne giving a great monologue, I think, in terms of the fact that I often don't like a monologue. It doesn't seem very natural. I mean, I do it all the time. Like, I talk for great minutes and don't let you get a word in edgewise, but like...
You're doing a podcast, so it is natural.
Okay. Natural in this situation. Not natural for this. He's just kind of filling the silence at this point. And so he's explaining to her how he got here and how there was like a truck and then he's outside this diner and he was like, the line is... But by now there were no more screams because nobody was left alive mm-hmm. inside of the diner. So that's why he took the truck and got away, because mm-hmm. everybody around him, he was like 20, 30 of those things, he says. So he like took the truck and got away. And while he's doing this, he's disassembling the table.
Right.
And she like takes the tablecloth from the table. Did you notice this?
Yeah.
And she like walks, she cradles the tablecloth and walks over to a chair and like lays herself in the chair.
She's like, oh, the lace makes me feel so comforting. She reminds me of Jodie Foster's character from Nell. I brought that up while we were rewatching it. And so I'm thinking all through all of these like moments where she's just sort of like, I'm thinking Tay in the wind.
She just, the lights are on, but nobody's home. Like, the wheel is spinning, but the hamster's long dead. She's just a few French fries short of a Happy Meal. She is a couple cards short of a full deck.
And kind of going back to your point where you feel like his exposition, you know, is kind of delivered in an unnatural way, but you still enjoy it.
Yeah.
I actually think that kind of speaks to his character, because he's like, I need something at this farm. I'm going to be here and I'm going to take time to run through like getting things taken care of.
He waited till there was a breath before he processed what he'd just been through. And right. That's what we're watching through that monologue.
But he's still like willing, but he still needs to process it. And he processes it by talking out loud to someone else who probably isn't processing it and probably doesn't, and she doesn't know what's going on. So he's trying to offer information so maybe she can start the processing. But that's not what Barbara does.
Because Barbara doesn't do anything good. She eats all the candy. Poor Johnny goes to his death on an empty stomach. She loses her shoes. She wrecks the car. She's now like badly, like she doesn't, I don't even know where her knife is anymore.
Probably with the wood. But like, okay.
So, oh, I think it is.
Probably.
Oh, I thought it was a steak, but it might have been the wood, the knife.
Maybe. So as soon as Ben like kind of finishes his story and there's like a moment to breathe, Barbara starts talking about her story, and she's just like, Ben is talking coherently.
Yeah. Barbara, you get the impression that he's telling you exactly what happened.
And you can tell his mind is still focused.
Mm-hmm.
But Barbara cannot. She is like,
because we were there. Mm-hmm. We were there. She's recounting the first 10 minutes of the film and she does it badly.
Yeah. Her memory stinks. Sorry, Barbara, I know your brother just died.
Okay, so this is where my notes say, I judge the shit out of other women's grief. Okay, intellectually, I know everybody grieves different. Everybody grieves at their own pace. It looks different on everybody. People in shock or going through those stages, I mean, classically disproven, but like the stages of grief that we're all familiar with, like, I get it. You're going to be at a different place. They're never going to come in order. She's in shock. She's coming out of shock. Maybe she's going to go back into shock. Whatever. But I don't like it because I'm a functional griever. So like when there's an obvious objective, I'm going to go to it. I mean, I have problems when there's no obvious objective. Mm-hmm. But she's got a guy there who's got a plan, who has a good plan, who's like willing to put in the work. And she's just like... And I told Johnny we don't have any candy. And he was like, I remember, and I used to scare you. And I was like, you stop it. It's none of the dialogue
right.
that is from the original part. And I get that people also statistically don't recount first person experiences very well. It's why eyewitnesses are not reliable in court.
Right.
Unless you have corroborating persons or other documentable evidence.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes me mad because I was there and she was like, and I was going to apologize to that man. Except
she wasn't.
She wasn't. What? Not at all.
No, she had no intention. We noted it at the beginning. She was not making eye contact. She was making it. So she was going to veer away. And that's when he grabbed her.
And Johnny fought that man. He fought him. And I'm like, oh, lady.
And I ran and I ran and I ran.
You've reached the end of the first part of our review of George Romero's 1968 cult classic, Night of the Living Dead. Thanks, Applauder, for returning for more great discussions on cinema's most peculiar and fantastic releases. Locked up tight in your house and need more film podcasts to keep you company? Quiet on the Set guys just released their discussion on Mars Attacks. Or if you need some suspense... Stream Queen's latest release is a scene-by-scene rundown of A Quiet Place. If you happen to be one of our frequent website visitors on shockedandapplaud.com, you might try searching for us in your favorite podcasting app as well. By subscribing to our feed, you'll be the first to hear from us when we crawl back up to the surface with more great walkthroughs. You can also find us on Twitter with the handle @shockedapplaud, or on Facebook with the handle @shockedandapplaud. We'll be back in 1 week with part 2 of our review. From Shocked and Applaud, thank you for patroning the peculiar.